Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
Tonight, we're going to kind of try to wrap up the book. We have on the last chapter. I call it one chapter. Chapter 9. Chapter 10 is four verses. And I think the last chapter was done that way with the given its own chapter so it could delineate a discussion between Esther and Mordecai. But it's really one finale. And we're going to cover that tonight, kind of focus on Esther. I've appreciated the feedbacks I got last week. Appreciate that. And some questions. You guys gave me two or three questions to maybe tackle tonight, do the best I can. So tonight, we talk about God's providential queen. And we see providence come through here in the end in a big way. And I love the end of Esther because we really do see her personality on display. And we see a queen who's been so confident. And I want to back up and remember this isn't, we like to draw pictures of her. It makes us more comfortable to say this is a grown woman because she is by now, even by those standards. But let's remember when she was taken, unless she was an anomaly, she probably wouldn't have been older than 16 or 17, right? This is how it was done. Xerxes didn't like them old, right? We have to remember how grotesque he was. But by now in the chapter, she's probably in her mid-20s, okay, at best, maybe her late 20s. But we see providence on display as we see this young girl be confident, calm, biding her time, learning, listening to her elders and mentor and Mordecai. And then when she finally does have the power, she comes through in a big way. And I think we sometimes overlook just how confident. This is not a wilting flower of a woman. You know, she goes through with some things. She doesn't leave the war to the menfolk, right? It's very much something she engages with and she sees it through. So tonight, we're going to explore those chapters, talk about how Esther and Mordecai execute their plan. I want to give some final thoughts toward the end on the legacy we see of Purim, and some of the things we can maybe see about some questions you guys had as well, and if we have time, some other ones that you may have tonight. But just to review, one thing I want us to have fresh on our mind is as we enter chapter 9, the two big events, we reflect back on the Mordecai and Haman and Mordecai's edicts, right? We finished chapter 8 after Esther overcame her horrifying ordeal with facing Haman, playing politics, being calm, doing it just the right way, and then accusing that vile Haman. He's the one who did it. You know, and in a society where accusing a man at all or anyone in the hierarchy, you better be right or we have evidence that punishments were severe. And she's aware she's a woman in a predicament. She's aware she's queen, but as Mordecai has told her, it doesn't matter that you're queen. You think you'll be spared? She won't. She knows. So we know after that ordeal, Haman is killed, and then she comes to Xerxes and collapses finally with the adrenaline crashing and weeping, telling him of her heritage. I'm a Jew. Xerxes puts it together, and you know, Mordecai comes in the picture now. Everybody cards are on the table, and Esther tells him, I need your help, Xerxes. We need a chance. So the edicts are issued, and this is important because with Persian law, it must be exact to reciprocate a law. You can't repeal it. We have Haman's law that uses language to destroy, kill, and annihilate young and old, women and children, executed in the month of Adar. Esther does the same thing in chapter 8. Mordecai, and it's implied Esther is there the whole time. That's significant in these patches. Esther and Mordecai are there. Xerxes gives Mordecai the ring, right, the signet ring, which is all power. And he's now Haman's position. He's the vizier, but Esther's right there, and they're planning. And they execute this plan by saying, okay, we're going to do the same thing. We have the right to attack any nationality or province who might attack us and to plunder their property because that's what Haman allowed. But we'll see that they don't do that. Not really. They don't take that opportunity. A couple things to keep in mind as we go into chapter 9. Let's remember that this was a sanctioned thing, Haman's decree of mass genocide. We want to remember kind of the thing about the way the empire was displayed. You know, we have all these satraps. This is a map of the empire divided up into the 25 or 30 satraps. Egalitarian as the empire was, you know, meaning it was very cooperative. The people were spread out. You had Bactrians here, but you also had some living over here. They were all kind of spread out. But the Persians, like the Medes here, that large satrap, they still sort of lived in their homeland. The Jews were different because of the nature of their captivity. We know in the satrap of Yehuda, and it was in the subunit, the satrap of Ebernari, which literally just meant other side of the river, past the Euphrates, is kind of what they called it. That area over there, oh, where the Jews are. That's how insignificant they had become, which is, again, why God is fed up with this. We know, again, about 50 million people, according to that era's census, lived in the Persian Empire, which may have been about half at the time. That's a big chunk of the world, about at least half or so. There were about 1 million Jews that lived dispersed through here. Maybe 40,000 or so inhabitants in the province of Yehuda, which matches biblical text. Maybe 1,500 to 1,000 in Jerusalem. This is when Nehemiah and Ezra are going to start their plans to rebuild, right? It's already going on. But the problem is, you know, we have the Yehuda satrap here, but the Jews don't all live there, right? The problem is, it looks more like this, right? Which is why Esther and Mordecai said this might work. The Jews are spread out. There's 1 million of us. We don't just live here anymore. We're everywhere. And if we can mobilize the one thing that they don't want us to do, we might stand a chance. Or maybe not. But we see in Esther 8 them talk about the revolt, this purge situation where Xerxes says, I'll allow you to defend yourself. I'll let you write the decree. But understand the consequences. Okay? So we see that happen. And the thing about it is, as we segue into chapter 9, the chapter ends with many other nationalities becoming Jews, it says, because fear of the Jews seized them. My, how the table turns, right? Now they're afraid because the edict has gone out. Everyone knows, and also word is getting out, as we see in chapter 9, Mordecai is now Haman. He's the vizier. Most people know he's a Jew now. It's implied it's getting out. What does that mean, right? Rumors getting out about Esther's nationality, okay? Sides have to be chosen. All eyes are now on Esther. Because now it's not a matter of legal or illegal. Esther is, a lot of commentaries say, you know, when in chapter 8, when he says, let's make a decree so that we can defend ourselves, says Mordecai and Esther, she's doing it not only to counter it, but she's giving everyone a chance, right? That's telling everyone, this previous law from Haman is still in effect, but the state's not going to back it up anymore. There's another one in effect. You got a 50-50 shot. Who are you putting your money on? That's what Esther's saying. And she's giving people a moment to decide, because once fighting starts, they have the right to defend themselves, and the Persian army won't stop them. So now it's that sort of, do you feel lucky, punk? You know, it's like, do you feel lucky? What are you going to do? So looking into chapter 9, we're going to read through some of this. This is something scholars call the great reversal. You'll see this in history. The great reversal of this plan, as we see the story pivot and the fates all reverse. We see the plan executed. Who's loyal to who? The redemption of God's providence is in play. Mordecai is orchestrating the defense, but Esther, we will see, lands the final kind of spiritual blow to make a statement at the end, right? And we see a legacy of fasts and feasts. So let's read the first few verses. Oh, before I do, I will remind you of this. I want to come circle around to this as we read chapter 9. I mentioned in week 2 or 3 about that reading a Hebrew. In a lot of Hebrew texts, both non-biblical and biblical, as a language, they had a tense called the divine passive, meaning if a statement never says who did something, it's trying to tell you, well, God is always active. And we see the Greeks even use, the Greek writers use it in Matthew, Luke, and John. For example, Luke, I use this as an example, the word agerte, he is risen. That verse is implying he got up because, you know, he was risen, raised up by plan, by God. That's intentional. It may seem like a little thing, but that's the Hebrew way of always putting God there without writing his name. Everything is happening according to plan. So in Esther, whenever we read a phrase like this, Esther was taken to the king's palace. The word is vatilaka. It just means generically unconjugated, take me to the palace. They did that on purpose to tell you, they're very deliberate, right? If they wanted to, the verse would have been written, Esther was taken by the guards to the king palace. But notice it doesn't say that. The Hebrew writers know what they're doing. They're trying to say, providence is making this happen. But that's intentional. This is not just digging here. This is, you can look in any Norton Anthology of Literature in a college and find that as a passive tense. For Hebrew literature. So we'll see God's providence in display. So the first 10 verses, let's read those and just talk about it. We're going to see the Jews triumphant. We're going to see people start to die. And then Esther continues. So chapter 9 begins. After everyone is afraid of the Jews. Now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. So we've had a year now. Now is the date of Adar. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Xerxes to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. Notice that phrase keeps coming up. Those who hated them, their enemies. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also killed Parshadatha, Dalphon, Aspatha, Paratha, Adalia, Aridatha, and Parmashta, and Arisai, and Aridai, and Visatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, but they laid no hand on the plunder. So here we see that first sort of volley taken, and Esther is not quite done. You know, in those first few verses, it picks up quickly. In verse 3 and 4, we see that Mordecai's new position is known. And it's key to talk about this because we see where the government's siding now, right? The nobles, the governors, the administrators, they still had Haman's decree and had the right to kill the Jews, but they decided not to. They're seeing the writing on the wall. Most of them were, there's no profit in it, right? Mordecai's a Jew, Mordecai's in charge. Maybe we go this way. They were afraid. Haman is gone, and there was the logistics of it. There are a million of these guys. Now that they've been given the right to fight, Jews have a bad reputation. Anti-Semitism ran rampant because of their past. Everyone reminded them about all the trouble they caused over the years. But they were dangerous because people remembered, what if they found their faith again, right? These are people afraid, but what if? What if the Jews are really galvanizing? Have they found themselves again? They know this. They know their history. Mordecai, as the vizier, commanded the bodyguard now too. So even if they did revolt, I went over this a few weeks ago, that position Mordecai now holds, he was the master of 1,000. He commanded the immortals, commanded the troops if they did turn. What were they going to do? So Mordecai and Esther sort of held the cards now. He has the ear of the king. So now sides are chosen. So continuing on in verse 11, we see her final request in some numbers here. That very day, and note in verse 10 it says, they killed their enemies, laid no hand on the plunder. That very day, the number of those killed in Susa, the citadel, was reported to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, in Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, and also the 10 sons of Haman. So Xerxes says, what then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your wish? Right, so he's saying, I haven't even heard back what they're doing the rest of the provinces, but reports are coming in. And remember, he used his fastest horses, so they could get back across the empire in about 9 days if they had to, but at this point, it's a 1 or 2 day aggression. What is it that your wish is, Esther? Now that this is done, it will be granted to you. So Xerxes is still, he's offering a favor, which is a big deal. And what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled. And Esther said in verse 13, which I think this verse is great and tells us a lot. Esther's not weeping or saying, whatever you want, Xerxes. She looks there. We don't see weeping here, right? When she comes and she weeps and says, please give me a chance. But now she stands up to him, looks him in the eyes and says, if it please the king, which is the correct thing to say in this instance, she knows protocol, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. Let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows and impaled on poles. Pretty brutal. They're already dead, right? We know they're dead. But Esther realizes this is not enough, okay? I know there are arguments of this. People will look and say, well, this is showing the brutality of God and the Hebrews, the bad guys here. Is it brutal? Yes. But God has commanded this generations ago, again, telling Saul to take care of the Amalekites. Taste, because the last time this was done was Haman's plan to hang the Jews. Was when Darius did it to an Egyptian revolt. He did it to some of their leaders. But the only time prior to that they had done so was when they did it to the Jews, when the Babylonians did it, when they sacked Jerusalem. Much like Brandon is talking about on Sunday morning, and Andrew, about giving us that history of 2 Kings. It's humiliating, okay? And so Esther is making a point here too and putting the sons up, letting everyone know that, in a way, I think that, you know, God is here. They've found their faith again. And we also see, as we look in these verses, when we see the word hate over and over again, the people who do take up arms, okay, we already see most of the government decided not to fight. That means all that's left are the ones who truly hate them, not based on patriotism. They're not doing it because they're good Persians. They're doing it because they hate the Jews, right? The ones that are left are their enemies, the Moabites, the Amalekites that remain, all their hatred, they still have a shot and they take it. But the Jews fight back. So that's important to note as well. Okay? So the king commanded this to be done. The sons of Haman were hanged. In verse 15, the Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa. So that's 800 men in Susa alone. But they laid no hands on the plunder. Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives, and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them. But they laid no hands on the plunder. This was the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested. And they made that a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and the 14th, rested on the 15th day, making that a day of feasting and gladness. See, Susa had an extra day. Therefore, the Jews of all the villages who live in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month, this day of Adar, as a day for gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. And this is important, too. A lot of historical stuff here with Purim, where it gets enacted. Okay, so as we're going to look at the next part here, but in these previous few verses, this is important for details, right, as we see the Jewish tradition being established and why they're doing it. So continuing to kind of get through more of the text, verse 20 to the end of the chapter, we see several things we need to pay attention to, okay? And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Xerxes, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month, Adar, and also the 15th day of the same, year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow to gladness, from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do, and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Habadatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast pur, that is, lots, to crush and destroy them. So it's kind of a summary of the chapter of the book. But when it came before the king, he gave those orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore they call these days Purim, after the term pur. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter, and notice it doesn't say the author, but we can sort of add what's implied there. Because all that was written in this letter by God, and of what they had faced in this matter because of God, and of what had happened to them because of God. The Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them, that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written at this time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, in every clan, province, and city, and that the days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. And we have proof it does not. Then Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew, gave full written authority confirming this second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Xerxes, in words of peace and truth, that these days of Purim should be observed at the appointed seasons, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them. This is rare to have a queen in here, even the Persian queens, okay? They just weren't even on the edicts, okay? Xerxes, she's got the signet power, just with Mordecai, too. She's ruling as much as a queen can in Persia. They obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fasts and their lamenting. The command of Esther confirmed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing. So pay attention to that. We have a saying here, it's recorded by Esther for them to carry on her own letters. Okay. So we see, again, the decree is written down in the records, and often we see that phrase, and we've talked about this a bit. We know the annals of the king and the records of Persia. A lot of those were destroyed, okay? So kind of a cop-out answer in some ways, but a lot of those were destroyed by Alexander the Great. We have most of the cuneiform tablets because they didn't burn in the fire when they burned down all the palaces. But we do have some references. We have other writers that reference these things as the years went on. We have them citing them as a secondary source. And we know that Esther wrote it down too. And that's important for how it gets preserved, for many things we've talked about this quarter that we'll go over again. So a couple of things I want to mention here, things from history, as well as evidence for Purim's celebration, the fast of Esther and then the feast of Purim. Okay, it starts with a fast, right, just as Esther did, to remind them to prepare themselves for what was to come. And the feasts were established. We know Josephus and his Antiquities records the Esther episode and notes the death toll in Susa at these numbers, mirroring the figure, and he says these are in the Persian archives. At this time, not all of them had been destroyed. Okay, this is after Alexander, but there are other references in history to where the Persian artifact, they were still out there. People still had some of them, okay? And we have the Book of Maccabees, which is an apocryphal book, but 2 Maccabees 15 from Jewish rabbinic tradition, which this is only about 100 to 200 years after this. We have record there of them saying this was Mordecai Day. Even in the Greek Hellenistic period, it mentions in that book they were celebrating Purim, the widespread acceptance of these events, right? The Megillat Tanit in the first century cites the 14th of Adar as a national day of rest. Megillat is the volume of Esther, that's what it means. Because salvation came in the days of Mordecai and Esther. Now, to us, it may seem like nothing. And I know we have faith and we believe this. But to the world, this means a big deal, too, because this confirms that it did start immediately when Esther said it did. We have records from the Elephantine Papyri in the West in Egypt at this period where they're already celebrating it, okay? And it still goes on today. Purim, again, means casting lots. Several of you had asked to go into that a little more. Of course, it's the memory of what happens in Esther. Typically, over the years, it has changed. We have historical records from the 5th century to now. It's changed dramatically in certain things that people do to recognize it as Jews. But we know there's a 3-day fast and wine feast. Esther 9, again, 26-28, tells us it was made official later. And these are things still continue today, but this started happening within decades of the festival. Stomping, clapping, hissing, whenever Haman, his name is said, you're supposed to go sss, you know, hiss. Children are giving things called graggers, these things at the bottom. I'll come back to that in a second. But whenever Haman comes on, you're supposed to make noise. In Hebrew, the words kind of ran together in my fonts there, but it's Yamak Shimo Batsikro. It means let his name and memory be erased, right? That's what they repeat. Let him be erased. And he was, conveniently, because we have the fortification tablets of Persepolis. We have the tablets that indicate Mordecai was at the king's gate. We have the tablets, 30,000 of them that are still being translated at the University of Chicago now, where we can see the sons of Haman. Their names are in there. So is Mordecai's. It's Marduk, OK? okay? You'll have historians say, well, it could be another Marduk, maybe. It's kind of like John as a name, I guess. Maybe there's John here, David here, Michael here. But come on, right? You can see their names, but Haman's name is not there. It's not there. But Mordecai's is. So they say, let his name be erased. Today, it's still tradition to read what they call the Megillah twice, Esther, the volume of Esther. Read it in the evening, read it in the morning in a synagogue. Do your noisemakers to drown out his name. You have to send gifts to friends and family of food and drink, as Esther says, at least two to two people poorer than you. Okay? Often, they have a meal with wine. Drinking is still a big part of it because it's associated with being married, the festival. The idea in Jewish tradition is that you drink, not condoning drinking, but the idea is that you drink until when you say the words, cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordecai, you can't tell the difference. You're having such a good time, right? That's what it is. And so people still do that today. Drink till they sound the same, because that's what it means. So they get a little toasted. Some do. Some don't observe all of these, but these are things that are still celebrated. They wear carnival-like masks in certain cultures. That's happened and grown over the last few hundred years. The idea was to wear, and it was supposed to symbolize the hidden nature of the book. You know, all the hidden secrets we have to dig for, and also not to embarrass the poor, right? As you're giving, you don't want people to kind of know. It was kind of to everyone's giving gifts. Early sort of a masquerade came out of this. Effigies of Haman were hung on gallows, right? And the children would beat them, you know, that kind of thing. So a big celebration, okay? Good reason. Get your gragger and say, you know, blessed be Mordecai, cursed be Haman. The phrase that they would say then and now is Shag Purim Samach, which means Happy Purim. Say that, you know, which one of my favorite traditions that's still carried on, and this started soon after the Book of Esther because we have 5th century records of these early foods kind of being made like this, sort of early baklava types, but they're called Hamantash or Azni Haman, called Haman cakes, okay? And or another translation is Haman's ears, and that's still done today, and I guess you can kind of see it. They're supposed to be little ears that are filled with treats inside, and you eat them, okay? Obviously, but they're filled with hidden treats, and it's supposed to symbolize, you know, Haman's weaseling ears there. He's hearing, he's always there, you know, all the things, secrets he knows, and the bribes offered, and you celebrate, you know, hey, we've got him, you know, it's kind of grotesque, really, you think, but they eat Haman's ears. But the three-pronged nature of it, Jewish tradition says it's also to remind them of the roots of the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which the king advanced him. Are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people, spoke peace to all his people. You can almost hear the fanfare and the credits roll, right? It's very Disney. Yeah. But it is a happy ending for them. But we see this confirmation of Mordecai and Esther telling us their historical significance, Mordecai's power, and Esther's role in preserving the story. And one final time, I'll come back to something I harped on for week after week. Tributes given in chapter 10, verse 2. It says, written in the book of Nehemiah, who's doing all this? Well, let's remember, it's the Magi, okay? But this is important because the Magi, the scholars, the truth seekers, have been watching all this come out, right? The story I told you about the Magi just a generation prior being wiped out by Darius, culled down to numbers that were tolerable. They were scientists and scholars, but Darius was afraid of them and their knowledge. But they were just truth seekers. They were an oppressed group who just sought truth. We know this from their teachings. They weren't Christian. They weren't even Jewish. They were looking for truth. And they were looking at Esther, okay? They were watching this queen, an orphan queen. You know, they've been through so much, these kind of robed individuals. This is the Beistun inscription again with Darius crushing the Magi's head. They were all over the palace. They were always listening, always watching. The eunuchs, all those people that were around Esther, and they see her triumphant, that she stands up to Xerxes, and she saves her people, something they couldn't do. Well, the Magi record all that in history. We know, we have their records where we go back to Daniel. Gotta go back to Daniel. We see where he's made the head of that order by Nebuchadnezzar. And he starts to inject that Jewish tradition. And now, couple of generations later, those magi who've passed it on orally and written on those tablets are saying, there's something about Esther, something about these people. There's a story here. The prophecies of Daniel and Jeremiah, all that stuff comes to do. It gets us to Christ. Because that's what this book's all about, getting us to Christ. My last bit of magi lore I'll share is this was important. This is what I think historically proves the connection to Matthew. After Esther, they're locked in, as my son would say, right? They're locked into the idea of, this is an ancient, I think it goes back to Assyria, actually. But this star here, it's an eight-pointed star. It represents the goddess Ishtar, which they combined with Ashtaroth, which is where Esther gets her name. God is working behind the scenes. God didn't bend his teachings around pagan ideals, but he used them, right? They were scholars and astrologers, and Esther, by keeping the line alive and keeping the traditions going, and it's worth preserving, right, these Jewish people. If they'd been wiped out, who knows? But we see the Magi often would reference numbers, talking about a star coming out of Jacob, and I'm not trying to promote numerology and all that stuff, but these prophecies that were there, Daniel, they knew that. They had their own concept of Messiah. They called it the Shaoshaint. They understood king, Messiah, divine. They knew there was something more. They didn't call it God, but they were looking for truth. And Esther showed them that way, in a way. She reignited that fire that Daniel started, and they keep it alive. And it's funny to me that while Ashtaroth is her name, Hadassah takes that name, in many ways they associate that in Magi literature with that star. Esther's that star, that first indication. And then we see a few hundred years later a star in Bethlehem. So there's a connection to Christ there by keeping that line going. So in the time we have, as we wrap the chapter, there were a couple of questions that people asked. I want to see if I can give a quick answer best I can. These are the three that most people asked. Did God move Xerxes in the way he hardened Pharaoh's heart? You know, when that happened in Exodus. Why was Mordecai at the king's gate? And what did happen to Esther? Okay? So I'll give you my thoughts on what history says. The first one, I'll just quickly, because I know we only have a few minutes, I think about eight more minutes or so. This one is a good one and definitely deserves its own class. Now, there's a couple of interpretations here. I know if we look at that phrase, hardened Pharaoh's heart, in Exodus 8, 9, there's plenty of opportunities to see this in the reading of Exodus, where sometimes it says Pharaoh saw something, he hardened his own heart. You know, this time also Pharaoh hardened his heart. He sinned yet again and hardened his heart. But then other times, we see the Lord saying, I will harden his heart. Now, you know, some interpretations say, yes, I have a problem. I think there's a problem if someone's truly repentant and God says, no, I'm going to cast, that's not how God works. I'm going to supernaturally throw you into hell. That's not what's happening. You know, he knows the nature. Pharaoh never was repentant, right? You know, I'm more of the belief that, you know, when it says he hardened his heart, it's more like he was hardened by the actions of God. But what we do know, there's a couple of interpretations there, but we do know Proverbs 21, and that's what I wanted to leave us with Esther. We do know that this is true. The king's heart, it says in Proverbs, talking about God and kings, the king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he pleases, right? Basically, the king, God is going to work it to his gain, right? He works Pharaoh's decisions. He hardens his heart. But without going into that tangent, as it relates to Xerxes, the language we have here, I will say, I think we can definitely see God working in providence. But that divine passive does a lot for us too. And most of the time, when we see Xerxes talk about Esther, I think he truly was taken by her, right? Most of the language says the king loved Esther. She obtained grace in his sight. When he saw her, he was pleased. So, you know, was God at work? Of course, with providence. I think it was more that the providence shows us he had Esther in the right place at the right time, the right woman, the right man, and did it that way. Did he force Xerxes to raise the scepter? I don't know the answer. You know, I wish I did. I don't think so. I think the scripture tells us, I would say this. I think it puts God in a box, right? He's worked him to this. Who knows for such a time as this? Second one, I answered a little bit about, I think, early on in the class, and it's been a while, but a couple of quick points. We can confirm this again in the Marduka tablets in Persepolis. He was at the king's gate because that was his job. There were several king's eyes around. They were called the king's eye in Esther. We know his court position was in the citadel, so he already had a job there. And the different verses tell us that he had a position in the court that allowed him to go back and forth between the courts of Esther and the harem, okay? So we know that. And again, we know his name is on there, and that the sons of Haman are on there. So we know a little bit about that. So Haman is, or Mordecai was at the king's gate because that was his job as a king's eye. Now the last one, I'll give a last couple of thoughts. The cop-out answer here is what happened to Esther. You know, we know what the Bible says, and that's all. And we have some history. There's a lot of tradition. I don't know exactly what happened. The romantic in me likes to think that God took care of her in a way that she lived a long life. A couple of things we know from history and tradition. There are traditions in Hamadan, Iran, where there are tombs that you can visit that are supposed to be Esther and Mordecai. It's a little northeastern of Susa. Kafir Barim in Israel claims that they're there as well. There's even a church that's supposed to be built over it. I'll be honest with you, I don't think that's true. I think it's more of a memorial. But it might be true. I don't know. That's what history says. They might be there. We don't know because the comforting answer is they didn't record any of the queens, okay? We don't know what happened to the queens from history that we know about from secular. Most of them weren't buried as the way the kings were. We just don't know. But the last thing I'll leave you with is what I think happened. Read Nehemiah 2, verses 1 to 8. Because we jump forward, I don't think Esther is a mistress. We went over that in week 2. A mistress is the king, queen that we know Xerxes was married to in history. Her name really translates to Vashti. She was cruel and mean. Esther was not. Esther was someone else. But I will say, Artaxerxes, if we look forward and this kind of ran it together, what catches my attention is only 2 or 3 times in the Bible is this word used. It talks about in Nehemiah 2 when Nehemiah goes to the son of Xerxes, Artaxerxes, who I don't think was Esther's son. It was son of Artaxerxes. But I think Esther was there. Because in Nehemiah 2, he goes to her, and when you read that, he says he's sad, and the king hears him out. And he says, I want to go back to the land of my fathers and rebuild it. And Nehemiah says the queen was sitting next to him. And what caught my eye, it's the only time the word shagel is used in this context. It doesn't call her the Malakah, which is queen we see in the rest of Esther, or the wife. Shagel was a term, to skip ahead, and this is the Nehemiah bowl. You can see at the British Museum. He was the cupbearer. He says the queen was there, the shagel. The shagel was something else. It could mean an intimate partner, but it was reserved for sort of an intimate older woman figure, okay? It was when the king, from age 5 to age 20, they actually didn't see their father much. They were supposed to be trained by the mother or grandmother or whoever the previous king had anointed as his consort. With me? And the word shagel means consort queen of nobility. It's a word like they're looking for. This is somebody else. She's silent here. But we do know that Artaxerxes and Ezra and Nehemiah, if you read it closely, he listens to them, right? Artaxerxes listens to Ezra and Nehemiah. He is sympathetic to the cause to rebuild, and it's implied that his teachings come from this woman who is with him, okay? But that word is different. So part of me likes to think that, again, until the 5th year, men do not come into the society, even the kings, but they pass their lives with the women. And in this case, it's interesting to me, it doesn't use the word Malakah for the king or the concubine even. It uses shagel. This is someone that is not Vashti. It's not a mistress. It's not Artaxerxes' real wife. We know her name. She goes by something else. So who's this mystery woman? I don't know. But inside, I'd like to think it's Esther. It's the stepmother. Esther would have been in her 50s by now, maybe older. But it is interesting, I would say. It's a tradition that I tend to lean toward, and a lot of commentaries believe that as well. If you want to check that out for yourself, because we can see Esther and Ezra being sympathetic. So I think these will all be uploaded on the website. I think it'll all be up in an archive of our slides. But I want you to think about it as we close the class. I hope you've enjoyed it. I have. Think about the chiasms of Esther. You know, we go from Jezebel 400 years prior destroying the empire to God lifting up the queen of his own to restore it. The banquets, the feasts, the Magi listening to Esther, keeping the line alive to get us to Christ. And some of these are things we've talked about already, lots of proofs that we've kind of already talked about. But I'll leave you with this verse as we see the providential queen take us to the true King of Kings, right? As we see Esther was a woman who took her such a time as this that we're all challenged to do, just as Christ did. In Colossians, we see that Christ himself disarmed the powers and authorities, and he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over the over them in the cross. Much as Esther put Haman's sons up on those gallows, Christ was a sacrifice with meaning. I've enjoyed the class. I hope you have too. If you want to go back and look at these when they're up on the website, I've got all my sources in here. Everybody asked for these. I put them all in here. Everything I've used to research for this class. More reading than you probably want to do, but more reading than I want to do sometimes. But thank you so much for the class. I enjoyed it. Have a good night.